Now, the War Telescope, presented weekly at this time by the News and Special Events Department of the National Broadcasting Company. But first, this message from our government. With thousands of our fighting men and women wounded in hospitals all over the world, everyone must ask himself, how can I help most? If you're an eligible registered nurse, active or retired, the answer is plain. 10,000 more nurses must be enrolled in the Army Nurse Corps at once, or wounded men will not receive the care they deserve. As an Army nurse, you're given the rank of second lieutenant and pay equivalent to $216 a month and experience to advance your post-war career. If you're a registered nurse under 45, wire for information. Government rate collect to the Surgeon General, United States Army, Washington, D.C., or inquire at your local Red Cross chapter. If you can't qualify as an Army nurse, take an essential civilian nursing job. Now the War Telescope, and for the story today, we take you to NBC in Western Europe.
This is David Anderson speaking from Luxembourg. The teamwork between ground and air forces on the American sector has reached a perfection hardly dreamed of in the early days of Normandy. Then, one spoke of air support being given to the ground troops, but not today. No less a man than General Arnold refers to this teamwork as air-ground coordination. But one arm of the service plays no less a leading role than the other. And in fact, air liaison officers are placed with all armies, corps, and divisions in order to ensure the smooth functioning of this air-ground coordination, to ensure that the best use is made of our powerful air force at the place most helpful to the boys down on the ground. In the studio with me today are three men, all experienced pilots, two of whom have worked directly with the Army in the field as air liaison officers. There's Lieutenant Charles R. Rowland of Pillow, Illinois, Lieutenant Charles E. Bennett, Jr. of Janesville, Wisconsin, and Flight Officer Joe Lackey of Union, South Carolina. These men have come along to tell us something about the functioning of air-ground coordination, the practical application of direct support one to the other. Lieutenant Rowland is perhaps best qualified to put us into the broad picture, since he is at present tactical air liaison officer with an American Army Corps. I hardly need to phrase my question, Charlie. What is your job?
I went to the Corps on the 1st of January of this year. Before that, I was with a reconnaissance squadron. My job is to see to it that targets selected on the Corps front are dealt with by the Air Force. For instance, into the respective divisional CPs come reports from recce pilots and patrols of the existence of supply dumps, tanks, and troop concentrations. Sometimes the target calls for immediate attention. At other times, we can deal with them in our own sweet time. But when a corps is attacking, constant air-ground coordination is necessary in order to soften the enemy, prevent counterattacks, and, in general, to facilitate the advance of our troops. The targets are pinpointed on a map, and the information is then passed back to the tactical air group concerned. When a corps is about to attack, a meeting is held at Corps headquarters between the liaison officers of the respective divisions. It may then be decided that one of the divisions has an especially tough assignment. The enemy facing this division may be stronger in men and tanks, and the terrain may be the most unfavorable. If such is true, then it is our job to allocate more aircraft to this division than to any of the others. For instance, if two groups of aircraft are available for all the divisions, then one whole group may be assigned to one particular division.
Yes, but war is one of those uncertain things. Is there any flexibility to a hard and fast rule set up in advance of an operation?
In the Air Force, Dave, there are few set rules. I can give you an example. At 9 o'clock in the morning of January 22nd, a TAC recce plane observed a mass movement of German armor and vehicles out of what was still the Ardennes Bulge. He called back to us and reported what he had seen. 2,000 vehicles moving eastward from an area west of Saint-Vit.
You then maintain radio contact with all the aircraft operating under your corps, don't you?
Yes, Dave. We have direct radio contact with the aircraft from our ground base. Well, anyway, within minutes of receiving this first message, planes already airborne were directed to the locality, and other planes began warming up on many airfields. The battle royal had begun. The weather was perfect. Not an enemy aircraft was in sight, and the German convoy, now bumper to bumper, was raked up one side and down the other with rockets and machine gun fire. What wasn't destroyed that way was bombed into oblivion. The reconnaissance plane that had spotted the concentration acted sort of an umpire. He directed the first flight of planes onto the target and flew as far south as the Echternach region to lead other aircraft up to the area of St. Vith. All other tactical targets for that day were bypassed, temporarily, that is.
Well, I can imagine that you don't pass up many targets for long. That gives us the broader picture of air-ground coordination. Lieutenant Bennett has probably been closer to the front line than most airmen ever get. Isn't that right, Chuck?
That's right. My work is probably within 50 yards of the front line.
And what was your work way up there?
Well, if I were to give it a name, I'd call it the ground controller for air support. You see, the Army feels that maybe the pilots are better equipped to tell what to do, even when working from the ground. We talk the same lingo. We know from our position on the ground more or less what the pilot can see, and instead of measuring distance by thousands of yards like our patrolmen, we use the mile as our scale. A pilot can understand those terms better.
I can well believe that. How long have you worked on this job, Chuck?
All of the pilots get a crack at this controller's job. We work for about 2 weeks at it and then go back to flying. I completed my 2 week period just a short while ago.
Then suppose you give us a blow-by-blow description of what you actually did.
I arrived at my appointed command post just the day before our drive started to push the Germans out of the Ardennes bogs. For the first time since I got into Normandy, I slept in a feather bed, and after a steak dinner, too. Despite the fact that enemy artillery was dropping all around, I slept well. For 2 days, I was compelled to remain at the CP since weather was too bad for flying. On the third morning, I was put into a tank and removed towards the enemy position. But as we got near, the weather looked too bad for air support. However, after a couple of hours, we decided to use air support after all. So we drove down to within 50 yards of the enemy. When we got there, we saw that our troops were too close to the enemy for our aircraft to bomb or strafe. So we parked in the woods for the night with our radio turned on. After a breakfast of K-rations the next morning, one of our anti-tank guns knocked out a Jerry tank which was moving along some 300 yards from where we were parked. We moved on shortly afterwards through territory recently held by the enemy. And since fighting was going on along a ridge just ahead of us, we moved into a hollow. But we could still see our objective, the little town of Montlebond. Some of our patrols were in the town, but it was still held pretty firmly by the Germans. There were also a few Jerry tanks in the neighborhood. About this time, a call came through on a radio from divisional headquarters telling us to expect some of our aircraft overhead. And sure enough, in a short while, a flight of P-47 came over asking for a target. I knew that some of our troops were inside the town, so I told the pilots to circle the town while our boys were pulled back. When the evacuation was completed, those planes really went to work on Jerry.
And that's where Flying Officer Joe Lackey comes in. What happened from there on in, Joe?
Well, on this particular mission, we were flying close support for the division situated just north of Montlebond. We contacted the ground controller, who happened to be Chuck, and were directed to orbit until the patrols could be withdrawn from the town. After the patrols had been pulled back, we were directed to bomb and strafe the south and southwest portion of this town. Thus we did in elements, my flight leader, Lieutenant Colonel, and myself going down first while the second element remained above, giving us top cover. After the first element had bombed and expended most of our ammo, we then gave top cover while the other element, Lieutenant Factor and Lieutenant Alton, went down. When we had completed the mission, it was a very impressive sight to see our tanks stand out with infantry columns following in their wake and move into the town. It's really a rare thrill among us to know that we've been able to help the boys that really fight the war.
The boys that really fight the war. That sounds almost like propaganda for the Army, Joe.
Whatever it sounds like, it's true. And don't forget that when we want help from the Army, they give it to us. If we can't see a target, they fire smoke shells onto it. And when we run into flak on these close support missions, ground artillery can be called on to give us counter-flak barrages. That seems to make air-ground coordination pretty complete. You boys help the foot-flogging doughboys, and they help you. But it occurs to me that this type of close work must have a very high morale effect, both on our own and the enemy troops. What about this from a Corps standpoint, Charlie?
Well, every once in a while, when there are no particular ground targets, or when the weather is too bad for close support, we get urgent calls from the divisions asking us just to send a few planes in over our frontline troops to strafe the German positions directly ahead. Usually, this is directed from one of the Air Corps boys in a tank. But when this is not feasible, we may just fly over on our own. In other words, it's our way of going out to say hello to our fellows and just kind of wish them luck.
How does this type of support look to you sitting in a tank, Chuck?
I know from personal experience the high morale value of close support work. Whenever my tank moved up to a forward position, the infantrymen showed a tremendous interest in what was going on. They knew that we were directing the planes from the ground because of the flying close ahead on. As soon as the planes located our tank, we could direct them to strafe anywhere within a radius of a mile or so, and we could pinpoint our own frontline position in contrast to those of the Germans. Many times when P-47s came low overhead, the GIs would get up out of their foxholes to wave at them, realizing that the Germans would be pretty well undercover by this time. One thing can be said, the Germans do not like to be strafed, and when prisoners are taken after such a strafing mission, they are pretty well shaken.
I can believe that, too. But as a pilot, Joe, don't you get kind of a thrill going down that close to the infantryman?
Well, it sort of depends on how much flak there is down there. But I will say this, it gives you a feeling of being one of the ground boys. When we bomb railway yards or bridges, we're going after inanimate objects, so to speak. But when you see those boys down below, and you realize you're helping them, the morale effect works both ways.
You know, our little session this afternoon has kind of given me at least a better idea of what you boys are doing. Air-ground coordination is, I can see, something very, very tangible. It's just one of the many things helping to smooth out that path to Berlin. Thank you, Lieutenant Charles Rowland, Lieutenant Charles Bennett, and Flight Officer Joe Lackey, for coming along this evening. And the best of luck to you in your future hunting. This is David Anderson winding up this week's War Telescope. I now return you to the United States.
Now here's news from the other fronts. American arms are dealing new and crushing blows today at the Japanese homeland. The Jap radio says that Tokyo has been blasted again for the second day running by United States carrier planes, and that the raid today lasted for 6 hours. Tokyo radio added that 600 planes took part in the raid, which began at 7 a.m. Tokyo time. This news is coming to you from the NBC newsroom in New York. Now a summary of the latest war highlights. Japanese reports that American forces are invading Iwo Jima and also Corregidor have not been confirmed, but the fleet raids on Tokyo and Iwo Jima continue a second day. Tokyo admits 6 hours of attack today by American carrier-based planes, and the Japs cornered in Manila turned down a surrender proposal, refused to release civilians trapped with them. In Europe, the new Russian drive toward Berlin from the southeast is closing on the fortress of Guben and Cottbus. Some Russian units, possibly just 35 miles southeast of the German capital. In the west, a heavy Allied bombing of the Frankfurt-on-Main Railroad Center and the Canadian Army cutting between Gosh and Kalkar, northern strong ports in the Siegfried Line. And that's the War Telescope for today. This afternoon you've heard from NBC's reporter in Luxembourg, David Anderson. The War Telescope is a weekly presentation of the NBC News and Special Events Department. This is the National Broadcasting Company.